Each week, American History TV sits in on a lecture with one of the nation's college professors. You can watch the classes here every Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. Next on Lectures in History, Purdue University professor Randy Roberts examines the connections between popular culture and World War II in films such as Casablanca and The Fighting Seabees, and in songs such as Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy of Company B. Professor Roberts also describes how patriotic sentiments made their way into comic books like Captain America. Purdue University is located in West Lafayette, Indiana. This hour and 20-minute class begins with a clip from the film Patton, starring George C. Scott.
I want you to remember that no bastard ever won a war by dying for his country. He won it by making the other poor dumb bastard die for his country.
Okay, what did we just see? We just saw George C. Patton from the classic movie Patton. It's not Patton, of course. Four stars on his helmet liner. Ivory-handled pistols, not as some people accused him, pearl-handled. He was dismissive of that. Ivory-handled, all the medals. This, for many of us today, is World War II. Hollywood's World War II, divorced from the real World War II. But what we want to look at today is how popular culture presented the war. How was the war presented in movies from the 1940s? How was it presented in comic books from the 1940s? How was it presented in athletic events from the 1930s and 1940s? How was it presented in Tin Pan Alley, in music from the 1940s? We want to look at how Hollywood, how Tin Pan Alley, how Madison Square Garden, how the comic book industry in East Side New York, how they presented the war. That's where we're starting. And we'll see slides. Where are we going first? Even before the war begins, popular culture is helping to define the issues in the war. Okay, up here. Who is this? Joe Louis, American boxing champion. When did Joe Louis win the title? If anybody knows that, I'll give you a hug. See, nobody's even going to guess, right? Right? No. No, he didn't. He wins it in the United States. Actually, he wins it very close to here. He wins it in Chicago, 1937. Okay. So Joe Louis wins the title, 1937. In 1936, he had lost a fight, the only fight he had lost up until that time in his professional career. He had lost a fight to the German heavyweight, Max Schmeling. Okay, when Max Schmeling had defeated Louis, he was a hero in Germany. He returned to Germany on the Hindenburg, that big dirigible, right? He dined with Adolf Hitler. He and Hitler watched the fight together, and Hitler was kind of slapping his knee the entire time. He became a hero, okay? Poor Lewis was disgraced in America, although the next year he got the chance to win the title, and he won it, okay? In 1938, he will fight a rematch against Max Schmeling, okay? The most important boxing match in the history of the world. Maybe, perhaps, the most important sporting event in the history of the world. These two characters, Joe Louis, American, African-American, representing democracy, openness, or as open as American society was at that time, versus the darling of Nazi Germany, Max Schmeling. Not a card-carrying Nazi, but certainly well-liked and familiar with the leadership of the Nazi Party. They fought on June 22, 1938. 70 million people in America listened to this fight broadcast over the radio. I mean, this is more than twice as much as any of Roosevelt's fireside chats. Roosevelt never even got close to it. I doubt if the last presidential debate got that close to it. Okay, worldwide, 100 million people. And they listened to the fight in Bombay, India, in London, in Paris, in Berlin, of course. All over the world, they're tuned into this fight. In Germany, they're huddled around their radios in the middle of night. They woke up to listen to the fight. Okay, so it was this enormous fight. There was a great picture in one of the an illustration in one of the New York papers, and it was wonderful. It showed a kind of an anthropomorphic globe, you know, with like kind of bug-eyed, sitting in the corner of the ring, and it said to the world that in point of fact, the entire globe is watching this event, okay? It helps define the war. Later, this story may be apocryphal, but it's often told. Later, when Joe Louis meets Franklin Roosevelt, President of the United States, Roosevelt felt Louis's arm and said, "Joe, we're going to need more arms like this to help defeat the Nazis." Okay, 1938, the war hasn't started. America's not in the war, but those shadows of war are all over Europe. Here's a poster from the fight. Here we have Max Schmeling and his wife, Anna Andrei, who is a famous actress, laughing, joking with Adolf Hitler. What else do we have up there? Okay, here we have a little clip of the fight. I could show you the full fight. It only lasts about 2 minutes and 10 seconds of the first round. But what do we have here? Let's take a look at the fight. And listen to what the referee says as they meet in the middle of the corner. Excuse me, middle of the ring.
Besides the unseen audience that is listening to this, but this great and enthusiastic crowd that have come out here and expect to see one of the greatest fights they've ever witnessed.
count them out. That's good, Andrew. That's the fight. It's over. First round. But again, what are we doing? We're understanding this emerging foreign policy crisis as a boxing match, okay? This is how the imagination works. It's them versus us. It's two people, two sides in a ring. Throughout World War II, sports will help define the issues of the war. One of the things that sports do, if we can move along, Andrew, okay? Football in World War II, okay? This is a, maybe I'm giving away something that you're going to be reading, okay? But, you know, one of the big issues at the beginning of the war is what do we do about America's spectator sports? I mean, the two most popular spectator sports in America were professional baseball and college football. What do we do about these sports once the war starts? After all, who plays college football? Who plays professional baseball? Young men, athletic, virile, strong. The exact type of people that are going to be drafted into the military and presumably will make brave, good soldiers. So, with the players gone, what do we do about the sports? Do we just cancel them? I mean, there was a lot of discussion. Well, let's just cancel baseball, professional baseball, until the end of the war. Let's cancel college football until the war's over. We have more serious work to engage our attention than mere sports. Well, 1942, FDR decides, no, we won't do this. That professional baseball is important to the morale of the country. That college football is important to the morale of the country. Therefore, what football and baseball did was to continue through the war in a different form. They muddled through the war, but it was still pretty exciting stuff. Yes, some of the baseball players that played professional baseball during World War II were over the hill. Some of them had ear problems and they couldn't go into the service. One poor guy had only one arm, okay? But he played and the game continued. And the key to sports in World War II is it gave a sense of continuity with the past. That for many Americans, thinking about why are we fighting the war, it's to go back to the America that we had before the war. And that meant the smell of grass in the springtime and summer at Comiskey or at Wrigley Field, or it meant going and watching Purdue play football against Ohio State and winning. Don't kid yourself. Purdue was a power in World War II. In 1943, most of the Purdue football players were gone, okay? They had been shipped off to the war, to battlefronts around the world. Only one returning football player from the 1942 season, a rather dismal 42 season, which I think Purdue only won one football game that year. I could be wrong, but I think that's what it is. You'll have to check me. Only one returned, but there was a program to train naval officers and marine officers. It was called the V-12 program. The V-12 program. What it did, and Purdue had a big V-12 program, this meant that students, athletes from other schools came to Purdue to be trained to be naval and marine officers. And while they were at Purdue or Notre Dame or any one of another 100 or so universities and colleges around America. While they were there, they could play football. So Purdue got, to go along with our lone Purdue athletes, a bunch of players from Illinois came over, a couple from Ohio State, a bunch from Missouri, some from Iowa, so all, even one from Indiana. I choose to believe this guy rarely got in the games, okay? He was more of a mascot. I don't know that. I choose to believe it, okay? And that's sometimes the way history is. It's what you choose to believe. So if I'm wrong, please don't tell me, okay? So what is Purdue? All this amalgam of players from the Midwest primarily suddenly show up at West Lafayette. What is Purdue? Undefeated. In 1943, I think we finished ranked, I don't know, third or fourth in the nation. We should have been first. We were the one undefeated school. I think the national champion, in fact, I know the national champion in 1943 was Notre Dame. And Notre Dame had one loss. Things have not changed, okay? Things have not changed. People are paid off. Radio polls are fixed, but I don't want to go there. Okay. 1944, the undefeated team, the greatest team in 1944 was Army. Okay. Army had this powerhouse with Doc Blanchard and Glenn Davis, both of whom will win Heisman trophies. They go undefeated. At the end of the season, of course, they played Navy. And they had a spectacular win against Navy, best team in the nation. What do? Besides winning games, they symbolize the United States Army overseas. Because remember, they're playing in 1944. You know, the season starts right after D-Day and continues almost to the Battle of the Bulge. So while American soldiers are marching, fighting, and marching through Northern Europe, the Army football team is plowing through their schedule. Football played a role for America in the war, okay? Sports, popular culture, played a role. Defining what America was fighting for, to return to what we had, and defining the enemy, values, our values. Okay, so sports are important. What else is important up here, Andrew? Comic books are important. Comic books helped define the war. Here we have up here Captain America. The first Captain America comic book appeared in April 1941. Okay, not long before the war starts. The first Captain America. And in this early period, Captain America is helping to define American values, fight for American values, and he was enormously popular with the American comic book reading public. Okay? Once the war starts, comic book heroes play their part. Okay, let's talk about some comic book heroes. What happened to them? Who enlisted? Captain America enlisted in comic book land, okay. Captain Marvel enlisted. Wonder Woman enlisted in the wax. Joe Palooka enlisted. Dick Tracy enlisted. Batman and Robin enlisted. The Green Lantern enlisted. Who haven't I mentioned? Superman. The Man of Steel. Originally, the Superman was going to be called the Man of Bronze. Superman's better, don't you think? And who is Superman? Strange visitor from another planet come to Earth with powers unmatched by mortal men, able to leap tall buildings in a single bound, more powerful than speeding locomotives. And who, disguised as Clark Kent, mild-mannered reporter for a great metropolitan newspaper, fights a never-ending battle for truth, justice, and the American way. Yes, that is Superman. But Superman didn't serve during the war. Why? Say, but you know, there was a debate in the inner sanctums of comic book land on what to do with Superman. I mean, let's face it. This guy has extraordinary powers, right? Not only can he fly, okay? He can, well, he can bend steel in his bare hands, and he can do all those other things we talked about, okay? He can make the world go the, I think that was in one Superman movie where he made the world go backwards or, you know, so the fear was this. If Superman enlisted and was fighting the Nazis, let's say, well, come on. Superman could fly over to Berlin, grab Hitler by the scruff of his neck, and bring him back to the United States for justice. That, in a way, demeans the very real effort of real blood and skin and bone soldiers. I mean, it would parody the actual suffering taking place in World War II. So they decided, well, we can't put Superman in uniform. He's just too powerful. So what they did is Superman goes down to enlist. Okay, he wants to serve his part. He goes as Clark Kent, of course. And he takes off his glasses, and he has to read the eye chart. And evidently, his X-ray vision malfunctioned. Because I think what happened, instead of seeing the eye chart in front of him, he was seeing like the eye chart in the next room. Like there's different eye charts, right? Okay, let's let that go for a second. And he reads the wrong eye chart, and so because of his eyes, he can't serve. Okay, he's unacceptable. But he fights fifth columnist activities in the United States as well. Okay, Superman's an interesting figure. Superman is one of these great composites of kind of junk culture from the 1930s. I mean, just think of all the different elements in Superman. First of all, he takes care of people, and he watches over people who are, in theory, weaker than he is, okay? Kind of like Edgar Rice Burroughs' Tarzan. And he's a mask crusader. You know, the Green Lantern, Zorro, there's all sorts of masked crusaders at this time. And is there a Christian element to Superman? Is there? Does it tap into our into Christianity? What? Yeah. Where does he come from? Okay, he's sent by his father to earth. He all sorts of miracles, right? Okay, I mean, you know, he doesn't turn water into wine, but there's a lot of miracles this guy, of a physical nature. Okay, he's a savior a little bit for mankind. Yeah, there's some real Christian symbolism in Superman as well. So all of these come together. Okay. What do we have? Superman. Not only do comic books define American heroism, it presents portrayals of the enemies. Let's look at some images. Here we have the enemy, the Japanese. This is like the worst racist characterization of the Japanese. The Japanese are presented in hundreds, probably thousands of comic books during World War II. They're presented as subhuman, inhuman, superhuman, whatever prefix you want to put to human, but not human, okay? Not actually like us, okay? The Japanese are presented as irredeemably evil. You know, one of the great books on World War II in World War II culture, a book called War Without Mercy, presents the battle against Japan, the battle in the Pacific, as an essentially racist war. I mean, we can see these racist characterizations in this comic book. What else do we have up here, Andrew? Here we have Adolf Hitler, you know, I don't know who this guy is. It's obviously a very thrilling comic book because you can't say thrilling comics unless it's not thrilling. And here we have some guy landing, and you have Adolf Hitler, and you have other Germans. Comic books and movies presented a bit more, I won't say complex, but nuanced view of the Germans. There were two types of Germans, right? There was the Nazis, these guys, and they're bad. There's no question about it. They are evil. They started the war. It's who we're fighting against. Not good. But there were also good Germans. After all, one of the two leading ethnic groups in America were German Americans. Okay, you take a look at the Midwest, filled with German Americans. We don't want to say all Germans. The government doesn't want to say all Germans are bad. Therefore, there were good Germans as well. No good Japanese, good Germans. Okay, a little bit more nuanced. So here we have it here. What else do we have? Do we have any other? Yeah, here we have Battle of Britain. I don't know, you know, we've talked a little bit about the Battle of Britain in here. I didn't mention these various crusaders. An oversight on my part. Please forgive me. What else do we have? Any other ones? Okay, so that is comic book playing their comic books playing their part in World War II. The single most important popular culture medium in World War II was Hollywood. Hollywood was it for American culture. Most Americans attended at least one movie every single week. Okay? Many, many Americans, if not most, attended more than one movie every week. This is the heyday of the Hollywood system. Now, think about who was in charge of Hollywood. Who were some of the moguls? Does anybody in here know? We would talk in World War II before in the 1930s and even in the 20s, the moguls who ran the studios. Does anybody know? Can anybody give me a name of a mogul? One of the leaders of a studio? Warner, that's a good one. There are a couple Warners, okay. There's Jack and Harry Warner, right? And they run Warner Brothers. Who else? Does anybody know? Disney, yeah. They made comics, but Disney was certainly a mogul, Disney Studios. And he'll make a number of cartoons dealing with World War II. Who else? Who? Yeah, Louis B. Mayer of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. Right, he was a mogul. People like Carl Lamel was a mogul. Harry Cohen was a mogul at Columbia, Lamel at Universal. Okay, what do most of these moguls have in common? Although Disney doesn't fit into this class. Most of them were immigrant Americans. Most of them had come from Eastern Europe. Most of them, for all of them virtually, except for Zanuck, were Jewish. Okay? What does that mean? That means when the war breaks out in 1939, when the Germans start their persecution of Jews, even before that, Kristallnacht and such, they are acutely concerned with what's going on. Jewish Americans, many Jewish Americans, still have relatives in Eastern Europe or in Germany. They understand what's going on. And so Hollywood was early into the game of informing Americans about what was going on in Europe. Okay? Although it was a bit more complex because Hollywood also made its money in foreign distribution of films. The old rule, the adage was, that a studio could recoup the costs for making a film in the United States, but the profits were made overseas, in Europe or in South America. Okay? So at first, Hollywood doesn't jump in against Hitler with 2 feet. But eventually, Hollywood films will be barred from fascist countries. They'll be barred in Germany, barred in Italy. And as the market closes, Hollywood, surprise, surprise, gets more adventuresome. Here's The Great Dictator, which parodies, makes fun of Adolf Hitler and Mussolini. What else do we have up here? Here we have, as America's moving closer to war, the story of Sergeant York. Who was Sergeant York? Does anybody know? Does anybody remember? Sergeant York. God, great hero. Come on. Somebody's got to know. He's a great Congressional Medal of Honor winner, a great World War I hero, okay, from Tennessee, from some holler, some backwoods in Tennessee that doesn't want to go to war. You know, he's presented as a pacifist, but he goes to war, he does his duty, he becomes a hero. You know, this is a morality lesson for Americans on the eve of World War I. We all have a part to do. Okay, so we have Sergeant York. What else do we have here? War breaks out. What is Hollywood going to do when the war breaks out? The government decides, the Roosevelt administration, that Hollywood had such an important part to play in winning the war that Hollywood becomes a war-exempt industry. If you are working in Hollywood, if you are making motion pictures, if you're starring in motion pictures, if you are a cameraman, a director, a producer, you could actually get draft exemptions. The same as if you were working in a steel mill in Pittsburgh, or a coal mine in West Virginia, or a farm in Nebraska or Indiana. You could get exemption because you were doing a valuable war service. The war was more than carrying weapons and going overseas. It was providing the necessary goods to win the war. In America, we have an organization, a bureaucracy, called the OWI, Office of War Information. Office of War Information. The object of the Office of War Information is to disseminate information about the war. Now, where does balanced information cross over into propaganda? It's not always easy to tell, but it did. The head of the Office of War Information was a guy by the name of Elmer Davis. Okay, so he's ahead of everything. You know, he's ahead. They're looking at music. They're looking at what's going in newspapers, journalism. They're looking at Hollywood. They're looking at everything, comic books, you name it. Okay, radio, it has its tentacles all over. In Hollywood, under the Office of War Information, the OWI, was another organization called the Bureau of Motion Pictures. Okay, the Bureau of Motion Pictures. Several people were ahead of the Bureau of Motion Pictures. Two of the main characters were Lowell Millett and Urich Bell. Millett and Bell. They were mostly in Washington, D.C. In Hollywood itself, the key figure, was our next slide, is Nelson Poynter. Okay, now, what am I saying? There were bureaucrats who were ahead of this bureaucracy. Well, that's nothing new. Okay. Most of these bureaucrats, however, that are going to oversee Hollywood during this crucial time were primarily journalists. They weren't filmmakers. They didn't really understand how messages are relayed through films and presented through films. They understand written messages and journalism. However, they're ahead of the organization. Early on, they put out an information, government information manual for the motion picture industry. Boy, is that a boring title. Okay. A manual for motion picture industry. What should Hollywood be doing in this crisis? They answered all the questions. Okay. Number one, every film, every director, every producer, every actor should ask the same question. Will this film help win the war? What was the job of Hollywood during World War II? It was to help win the war. Films should show Americans making sacrifices, average Americans, planting victory gardens, participating in scrap iron metal drives of one sort or another. When they go out to visit a friend, taking their own sugar. Remember, sugar's being rationed at this time. Cigarettes are being rationed. Meat's being rationed. Rubber's being rationed. Or tires and rubber's being rationed. What else is being rationed? Gasoline's being rationed. So we should show Americans making sacrifices. Sacrifices to help win the war. Giving up their seat on a train to a serviceman, carrying particularly light parcels. Don't be packing big bags like, sometimes you see people go away for the weekend and they take one of these trunks larger than I am. Okay, no, that doesn't go in World War II. So help win the war. The war's also presented in a particular way. The war is presented as a people's war. A liberal internationalist crusade against fascism on the side of the people, okay? The little people, the average American, Briton, French, whatever you want, Pole. That is the war they're fighting against fascism. What do we have here, okay? The war, the Hollywood also was in charge of presenting our enemies and our friends in a particularly good or bad light. For example, our friends. Who are our allies in this war? Great Britain. Who are our major allies? Roosevelt will talk about the four policemen. Who are the four policemen? Does anybody know? Well, USA, we're one, right? We're one. Great Britain, that's two. We're halfway there. Who else is fighting on the Allied side? Russia, exactly right. The Soviet Union and China. That's right. United States, Great Britain, China, and Soviet Union. Okay. So we have three main allies. There's other allies, but these are three main allies. Well, how are we going to present these allies? For example, Great Britain. When we think of Great Britain, we think of what? Kate, okay, yeah, okay, and then Harry, and the other brother. What's the other brother's name? William. Well, but they weren't thinking about that in World War II. Okay, they're thinking of people probably equally silly, but we think of Great Britain, we think of aristocrats, class systems. Okay, so the object in presenting Great Britain was to present the British without a class system. Oh, yes, they have some aristocrats, but it's kind of cute, okay? It's not, they're more like us. So, with the Chinese, the problem with the Chinese, and our military found it out, was the incredible inefficiency, okay? I mean, it was, and we had always had this view of China. So, the idea of presenting the Chinese is to present it as a democratic, efficient society, fighting to win the war. Now, our generals who were working with Chiang Kai-shek found that that was often not the case, but we don't want to tell the American people this, okay? We want to present as good a picture as China as possible. We want to present a picture that's great, that's straight out of Pearl S. Buck's The Good Earth. Nice, decent, democratic, family-loving, earth-loving people, okay? Now, the hardest one to deal with were these guys. The Soviet Union, because really there was no great love affair with the Soviet Union and the United States, except among a small percentage of American communists, okay? The rest of America, we don't want communism. We don't want creeping socialism. We're still hearing that in our election as I speak today. We don't like it. The Russian Revolution occurs when? 1917. Very good. When does the United States actually recognize the country, the Soviet Union, that emerged from this election? Does anybody know? 1933. So, for what, 16 years, we pretended the Soviet Union didn't exist. We didn't want it to exist. We hoped it would go away, just as we hoped Red China would go away for a number of years. Only finally, when we thought, well, maybe we can develop some kind of trade relations with the Soviet Union during the heart of the Great Depression, did we decide to recognize the Soviet Union. But even then, there was no great love for the Soviet Union. Wars, however, make really strange bedfellows, right? We didn't plan it this way, but now, suddenly, we're in a war, and we're allied with the Soviet Union. And we send over some of our supplies, lend-lease supplies to the Soviet Union. And Hollywood gets in the act, making the Soviet Union look like a really benign place. Not a place that had killed several million of its own people, okay? Not a place of famine and purges and all the other nasty things that had gone on, but a really kind of nice place. So we make a movie like Mission to Moscow, which is about a mission of an American ambassador to Moscow dealing with, we can see on our your right there, Joseph Stalin. Joseph Stalin, this repressive, brutal, paranoid dictator, becomes kind of Uncle Joe, sort of a nice guy, okay? The kind of guy maybe would, you know, sit your daughter down on his lap and, you know, pat her and read her a bedtime story. Nice person. And what else do we have? We have another, don't we have another one? I thought we had, we don't want this one yet. What's next? Yeah, the North Star. You know, another one. Look at this. Love story in Russia. What is that? Bursting with blazing emotion. Dana Andrus, yeah, Ann Baxter. We had this movie. Another one was called, Song of Russia, kind of a song and dance number, you know, where, you know, Cossacks were singing and having a good time and drinking vodka and doing those exotic Russian dances. Okay, the idea is to present the Soviet Union as really, really good people, okay? Nice people, democratic. Yeah, they're communists, but communism is just Americanism spelled in the Cyrillic alphabet, right? That's right. That's all it really is. They're just like us. The idea is making our friends seem friendlier, or our allies seem friendlier, and our enemies seeming meaner. Okay, I was trying to think of put an ER on enemies, and it wasn't coming out right, okay? Anyway, so this is it. Let's show a little bit of the previous one. Here we have a news clip. One of the things, if you went to a movie in World War II, oftentimes you'd see a double feature. You would also see, you'd have a Disney cartoon or a Warner Brothers cartoon, often on a war theme. But you'd also have news of the world, okay? And you would have these film clips that would just give you information. Here's one on Hollywood in World War II. Yeah, da 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 da. United News. Everybody joins the U.S. war effort, even the stars.
Hollywood's most famous movie stars leave the film capital to help the government sell war bonds. Irene Dunne, Ronald Coleman, Hedy Lamarr, Greer Garson, all part of a contingent of some 50 screen celebrities giving their time and talents to aid the national war effort. The country has asked the people to invest $1 billion in 1 month to help pay for the war. And here's the start of the drive. Boarding a special train for Washington, they'll tour 300 cities from coast to coast. go to any city that agrees to subscribe at least $1 million. Yes, in democratic America, everybody is doing his bit. There goes Jimmy Stewart on his way to enlist. One of the most popular stars on the screen. Joining the Air Force as a private, Jimmy has now won promotion. Today, he's Lieutenant Stewart, USA. That husky young Negro en route to an Army induction center is the heavyweight boxing champion of the world, Joe Louis, the boy who beat Max Schmeling. The Army can use that fighting spirit, and Joe Louis is now a corporal of cavalry, somewhere in the West.
Somewhere in the West, who knows where? It's Kansas.
From all walks of life, even from the nation's highest tribunal, a Supreme Court Justice, Lieutenant Colonel Frank Murphy, answers his country's call. A veteran of the last war, he saw service overseas. Back in uniform, the judge is again ready for duty at the front. Moviegoers of years ago will remember Jackie Coogan. Charlie Chaplin made him famous as the Kid. Well, Jackie's in the Air Force now, a staff sergeant and qualified glider pilot. A movie star of modern times is sworn into service. Tyrone Power, hero of many a daring exploit on the silver screens of the world. He'll now play his greatest role as a Leatherneck Marine. Somewhere in Egypt, President Roosevelt's eldest son, James, sees war as a major of Marines. Today, that experience stands him in good stead. For communiques report, Major James Roosevelt is with the Marines battling in the South Pacific. Franklin Roosevelt Jr. is in uniform. His fellow officer is Douglas Fairbanks Jr., a lieutenant in the Navy. Young Doug, like his famous father, every inch a man, is serving with the fleet. Clark Gable, at 41, renounces his throne as America's most popular film star to join the United States Army Air Force. Enlisting as a private, his ambition to become a crack aerial gunner in the crew of a bomber. The only son of General John J. Pershing wins his promotion from private to second lieutenant. The Army's Chief of Staff, General Marshall, personally awards...
You get the point. You get the point. And I'm going to grow one of those mustaches because I really like that. Anyway, you get the point. Everybody is pitching in the war effort. You know, Clark Gable, Tyrone Power, Robert Montgomery, directors like John Ford. Well, almost John Wayne. He sort of tries to enlist, but mostly he stays in Hollywood and makes movies. But he makes good movies. He makes some good movies in Hollywood. Yeah, everybody is doing their part. Humphrey Bogart. Yeah, he's a little bit too old for the service, but he's doing his part, starring in movies. The enormously popular 1942 film, Casablanca, that looks at the free French allies of the United States. Yeah, with Sidney Greenstreet. What else do we have up here? Here's an interesting one. Very popular. It won the Academy Award, I think in 1942. Mrs. Miniver. Has anybody seen Mrs. Miniver in here? Not many. One, okay. But that's good. That's good. It's a quality one. This is a film about Great Britain that takes place at the before and during the Battle of Britain. And let me just summarize quickly. Some people die. At the end, a minister gives a sermon in which he talks about why are we in the war, okay? We're trying to define the war for an American audience. It's not a British film, it's an American film. Okay, why are we in the war? Let's hear what he has to say.
Many of us have been destroyed. The lives of young and old have been taken. There's scarcely a household that hasn't been struck to the heart. And why? Surely you must have asked yourselves this question. Why, in all conscience, should these be the ones to suffer? Children. Old people. A young girl at the height of her loveliness. Why these? Are these our soldiers? Are these our fighters? Why should they be sacrificed? I shall tell you why. Because this is not only a war of soldiers in uniform. It is a war of the people, of all the people. And it must be fought not only on the battlefield, but in the cities and in the villages, in the factories and on the farms, in the home and in the heart of every man, woman, and child who loves freedom. Well, we have buried our dead, but we shall not forget them. Instead, they will inspire us with an unbreakable determination to free ourselves and those who come after us from the tyranny and terror that threaten to strike us down. This is the people's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
What kind of war is it? People's war. What did Poynter and Bell and Davis and the manual have to say? What kind of war was it? A people's war. A people's war. Here it is presented as clear as possible. I mean, there's no escaping what type of war that World War II is. It is a people's war. It's for all the people. We're all fighting it. Some films were blatant. Let's go to the next one. Some films are blatant. Some aren't. Let's take a look at just a short clip, a song from a John Wayne film. This is a Republic film, The Fighting Seabees. All Republic films, I think, contractually had to have a song in it. They all have songs. The songs are all bad, okay? So I say, let's listen to a bad song and try to analyze what it says about America and World War II. Hit it, maestro.
And so, to you gentlemen of the Donovan Construction Company, who have been so devoted, so unbegrudging, so stuffy, so douche. Ladies and gentlemen, I have a toast to offer. Mr. Donovan.
What are you working on? What are you working on? What are you moving on? I push, I push, I push. Hey, what are you pushing, John? I push it aside. What are you pushing, John? On the Delaware like a one, the Delaware like a one. Hey,
where do you work, me boy? Oh, I'm in Donovan's employ.
How's your boss, me boy?
He makes work and seem a joy.
Hey, how are you doing, Jock? Have money in every sock. And who do you work for, Jock? A man you better not knock.
Hey, where do you work, you? Whenever there's work to do. And after the war is gone, there's plenty more work to be done.
Hey, Zachimpra Potezian, who can tractor a Donovan? Zachimpra Potezian, and what do you like to eat? I am crazy for caviar, but I haven't got caviar, so I eat everything that on.
Hey, caviar, they put me on, and who you work with, John? Oh, I'm the man you see, who do you like to know?
Did I lie? Is it a bad song? Truth and honesty here, it's bad. What does it have to do with World War II? What's that song saying to you? What's it saying to the audience watching this wretched song? What takes place in that song? Think about it. It's a series of verses, right? About this guy you better not knock. Okay, Donovan. Who sings the verses? You know, first you hear that an Irish brogue singing it. And then a Scottish accent sings a verse. And then an English accent sings a verse. And then a Russian accent sings a verse. What is the song saying? The song is saying this war is being fought by different people, by Scots, by Irishmen, by Russians, by Englishmen. You know, our voices are different. Our accents are different, but we're singing the same tune. Okay? It strikes a chord of unity. This is the purpose of this song, to show that it is a people's war, that all the allies are following the same band leader, maestro, whatever you want to use. Yeah. So Hollywood throughout the war, you can take any Hollywood film, you can deconstruct the film, and you can see how this film was intended to help win the war. Now, there are some really wretched films that would be a little harder with, but even lousy B movies, even the Sherlock Holmes movies of Basil Rathbone have war themes. Now, you're saying, wait, Sherlock Holmes, that's back in the, you know, the 1890s or early 20th century. No, Sherlock Holmes came back in World War II and was fighting against Nazis in Great Britain and the United States. Okay, what else do we have here? I think we're ready. No, we want out of that. Music plays a role in World War II. And I will race through music and give you guys some extra points for being so nice. Okay. Let me say, right after Pearl Harbor, there are over 100 songs that were written about Pearl Harbor. Over 1,000 songs. Let me give you some of these songs to give you some idea. These are not classic songs. You're a Sap, Mr. Jap. We'll nip the Nipponese. We're going to change the map of the Jap. The Jap don't have a Chinaman's chance. Let's take a rap at the Jap. We're going to find the fella who's very, very yellow and beat him red, white, and blue. Okay? Yeah. It doesn't suggest art, but it suggests emotions. It suggests a feeling in America that we've been attacked dastardly. Day that will go down in infamy, live in infamy. And we don't like it. Okay? Music will play a part throughout the war, just as it did in World War I. World War I had great songs. Keep the home fires burning. It's a long way to Tipperary. Over there, great songs. There was a bureau, a committee that was created among music makers, Tin Pan Alley, writers and producers of music, to create great World War II songs. And at first, they create some good songs, but doesn't have that much to do with World War II. Let's get a little take. This is an early one, Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy Company B, Andrew Sisters.
Chicago way. He had a boogie style that no one else could play. He was a top man at his craft. But then his number came up and he was gone with the draft. He's in the army now, a blowing reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. They made him blow a bugle for his Uncle Sam. It really brought him down because he couldn't jam. The captain seemed to understand. Because the next day the cap went out and drafted a band. And now the company jumps when he plays reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. A
Pretty good. Pretty good. I mean, that's Star Search material right there, okay? Yeah, it's a little combination of The Voice with, what's that other show? It's my guilty sin. Dancing with the Stars. Anybody watch Dancing with the Stars in here? Nobody watches it. No, I'm really embarrassed. Oh, man. Anyway, okay, what else? But, you know, doesn't have that much to do with World War II. Okay? Kind of catchy. If you like that big band sound, okay? But doesn't have much. You know, we're looking for a song that deals with World War II. Great Britain fighting the war, they had songs. Let's play a little Wing and a Prayer. Okay, coming in. It's a plane coming in, landing. Wing and a Prayer.
Coming in on a wing and a prayer. Coming in on a wing and a prayer. Though there's one mortar gone, we can still carry on. Coming in on a wing and a prayer.
What a show.
Okay, you know, I mean, there's specificity in that song. What a show, what a fight. We really hit our target tonight, okay? And we're coming in, one engine gone, you know, two-engine bomber. We've got our other engine going. We're going to get in there on a wing and a prayer. Okay, this is Great Britain. It's a war song. It's I mean, you can feel the Battle of Britain or the wartime missions over Germany, the nighttime missions that the British flew over Germany. The United States got the daytime missions. But you can feel it. Oh, and you can feel it in this song, The White Cliffs of Dover. Here we have some Spitfires.
The shepherd will tend his sheep, the valley will bloom again.
A little bit too much plain music in there. But again, the specificity. It talks about, you know, the valleys will bloom. Children will go to sleep in their own beds again. Where are children sleeping in Great Britain now? Why would that line be put into the song? Yeah, children are sent to the country to get them out of the cities. The cities are being bombed. Children are sent to Australia, or more likely to Canada, to Andrew's home country. Yeah. Okay, big ups to you Canadians for that. Okay, yeah, this is where they're going. This song is about, it almost prays for a restoration. Bluebirds over the White Cliffs of Dover. What's over the White Cliffs of Dover now? At this time? Bombers! You know, they're fighting over the White Cliffs of Dover. Brits are being killed in Spitfires and hurricanes over the White Cliff of Dovers. It's a dream of a world that's coming. Great specificity. Written by people that understand what war is about. The United States, again, it was more difficult for us because America didn't have that specific of an engagement with the war. I have some of the songs that were popular early on. We heard Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy of Company B. Goodbye, Mama, I'm off to Yokohama. Here's my favorite one. Send a big salami to your boyfriend in the army, and he'll bring home the bacon to you. I've heard all of those songs, okay? I mean, they were recorded. America's looking for a song that speaks to them. They will eventually get it. Which one do we have next here, Andrew? They're going to get it, interestingly enough, from a songwriter named Irving Berlin, okay? Son of immigrants from Russia, okay? Who will write, you know, a Jewish immigrant from Russia who will write the most famous Christmas song ever, okay? And you've all heard this. This will become America's top-selling song, 1942, 1943, 1944, 1945, 1946, and 1947. One of the leading selling song in all of its manifestations, but recorded by different people in the history of American and Western songs. Okay, the only one that eclipsed the initial song, the initial recording by Bing Crosby. It was finally eclipsed by a song called "Candle in the Wind." Does anybody remember that song? Yeah. It came out right after Princess Diana died, and it actually sold more. But until then, this was it. So let's hear it. What are you getting from it?
This song gives me a chance to keep a little promise I made to myself. I said I was going to sing this song at the end tonight.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know, where the treetops glisten and children listen to hear sleigh bells in the snow. I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, with every Christmas card I write, may your days be merry and bright, and may all your Christmases be white.
Okay, now when you listen to that and you think about 1942 when it comes out, it's a Christmas song. Obviously, there's no religious connotation to it whatsoever. You know, this is a time where there's an attempt to get an ecumenical unity in America. This is a time when Hanukkah becomes known as the Jewish Christmas. This is an age where the expression, the term Judeo-Christian tradition is originated. But when you listen to this song in the context of the war, what are you thinking? Do you like the song? How many people like this song? Love the song, okay? It's a sad Christmas song. One person said it was the saddest, bluest Christmas song they had ever heard. Okay, it's an incredibly sad song, but it touches some touchstones of American culture. You know, when I listen to it, I think of a New England Christmas. I think of sleighs. I think of Vermont or New Hampshire or Maine or Western Massachusetts. I think of Currier and Ives and all these images of Christmas that make you want to buy beer in Budweiser commercials every year, right? I mean, yeah, believe me, Budweiser are touching the same themes as this song. Yeah, exactly. It's a dream of a... It's a song about restoration. Restoring an America that's gone. I'm not at that Christmas. I'm not there with you. I'm dreaming of the Christmas. A Christmas what kind? Just like the ones we used to have. I want to get back to them. I mean, In World War II, one out of every 10 Americans moved to a different state. Okay? It's a time when the American population is unsettled. It's moving. They're not home for Christmas anymore. And they're dreaming of this restoration. This idea of restoration becomes an important theme in other songs. What other ones do we have? Oh, let's just, here's Dinah Shore. Yeah, go ahead. No, go back to Dinah. Okay, you'd be, no, back to Dinah. Well, what is this? Enough of that. That's getting a little sultry. Okay. Yeah. Dinah Shore said, you'd be so nice to come home to. If this is an incentive to get back to the United States, to finish the war and get home, I don't know what is. Okay. Yeah. So these are the songs people. What else do we have? Okay, there's two songs. Let's play the beginning of this. This is two songs that I think will tear at your heartstrings. Okay. Hit it. Country, if you like country songs.
Hey, I'd like to give my dough to Uncle Sam. You see, sir, I'm a blind boy. Yes, I am. I'd like to do my part to show what's in my heart and help my country win this war that we are in.
Okay. We have a blind boy. He has a seeing-eyed dog. We all have to make sacrifices, right? He wants to give his dog to Uncle Sam to fight for freedom, to save the country. And you know what? He does. Second song. This is the one that's going to kill you. Get some of your Kleenex out.
I gave my dog to Uncle Sam in 1943. He sailed across the sea and died for liberty. Now that you are sending heroes home, I just can't understand. Why don't you send my dog home, Uncle Sam?
Are you people that hard-hearted? The dog died for liberty. Come on, show a little compassion. Yeah, it's a great song. All he wants is for the remains of his dog to be shipped home. I want the same thing I've told you about. Coco, yeah, that's right, believe me. Anyway, this is music in World War II. Let me finish with a last kind of combining music and film and the idea of restoration and what the war is being fought, all wrapped into a bow with a fabulously successful 1944 movie called Meet Me in St. Louis. Now, it's about the St. Louis World's Fair. What year was the St. Louis World's Fair? Does anybody know? 1904, I believe. Because it was the same time as the St. Louis Olympics. They were held in conjunction. Okay, 1904. So here's a film, has nothing to do with the war. It's about 1904. It's about a family crisis, and the crisis is the father gets a better job, but he's got to move his family to New York. And they're so sad that they're going to leave this wonderful Midwestern town, has nothing to do with the war, and have to go to New York. And you have this little girl, and she's so sad because it's Christmas time, and you know what she's worried about? How will Santa know where to find us next year? Okay? And in this crisis, Judy Garland hits, as she always did, the perfect note.
Pretty silly trying to get them on the train, wouldn't we?
Beautiful song, beautiful song. But this was World War II. It's a disruption in a family. The family is American family. We're all in the war together. You know, maybe next time we'll all be together, if the fates allow. Until then, we'll have to muddle through somehow. I love the use of the word muddle. Muddle is such a classic English word, okay? I mean, coming from Great Britain. It's really not as much of an American word, but it's a word that comes into our vocabulary, the American vocabulary, more in World War II, because it's a classic British expression. Well, we'll just have to muddle through. This is a song about hope that we'll all be together again. It's more of a prayer that we'll all be together again, but it has this sad sense that it won't happen. It has this something that pulls at my heart that says it's never going to be like it was. That World War II has changed America. Okay, I know I've kept you a little bit longer, but these are the sights, the sounds of America. This is popular culture in America. Thank you. Okay. That's sweet of you. ID terms to Andrew and to Andrew.
Join us each Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern and Sundays at 1 p.m. for classroom lectures from across the country on different topics and eras of American history. Lectures in history are also available as podcasts. Visit our website at cspan.org/history/podcasts or download them from iTunes.